Welcome to So Many Bits. I'm your host, Bill Nielsen, and joining me from this palatial, anonymous office space in the middle of nowhere is Shelby Mongan. Shelby, how are you?
I'm lost in the middle of nowhere. I'm good.
It's better than being in parts unknown.
Unless it's that show specifically that Anthony Bourdain, rest in peace, had. In which case, I would totally travel with him.
Well, the unknown parts that I'm okay with are the ones where video games live. You had a look like I didn't know where I was going. I knew where I was going.
I know that podcasting is an audio medium, but I hope that listeners can feel the look I just gave you through their headphones. But no, that was...
It was one of deep distrust.
It wasn't not a segue.
Look, anything can be a segue if you try hard enough. Later on in this episode, we're going to have a nice interview with someone in the video game industry. But first, Shelby, you and I have to do some screen watching.
We do indeed.
I was outside watching some deer frolic. You don't even care about the outside, do you?
So for this, we are picking out your choice, which is... Okay, honestly, we should probably ration how many times we... Should we ration how many times we say the name, or do we have to say it in not a multiple of three?
Just not in a... Well, if you say it three times... So this is, I think, the reason why there was an unfortunate nickname used throughout the show. Actually, I legitimately... We'll talk about this. I think there's, like, legitimately a canon reason for it.
Okay, good.
So if we say it three times...
Every sixth time is good. Every third time is bad, though, right? Because three more times will...
We'd have to do three more times to get rid of it. Yeah, exactly. We're talking about Beetlejuice.
Beetlejuice! It's showtime!
I've knocked out one. We have two more.
This is the television cartoon Beetlejuice.
Spelled Beetlejuice, not Betelgeuse.
Right.
Like other spellings of him, but literally spelled like bug, sugar liquid, Beetlejuice.
Mm-hmm. Based on, the film of the late 80s. Mm-hmm. And this was the episode titled Vidiots, Season 4, Episode 25, original air date 11/11/1991. Now, I want to mention here a line from the Wikipedia entry for Beetlejuice episodes. Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. The first season consisted of 13 episodes. The second and third seasons each consisted of 8 episodes. The fourth and final season consisted of 65 episodes.
The 90s, the late 80s and early 90s was a wild time to exist. What seasons mean nothing to these people?
I don't think they do. I think it's just like get them out the door. They didn't quite hit 100, but it got put on other cable networks later anyway, so.
Yeah, it was originally, what's weird to think about too when I was looking up about the show, this was on ABC and Fox. Like, this was a normal channel show before it went niche. And yeah, like I think you said before, or when we were talking before, it was on Cartoon Network later. It was reshown.
Yeah.
And it was syndicated much later because I would have not understood what was happening had I watched... Let's say this episode when it aired.
Zygotes aren't that great at comprehension.
I was alive. How dare you?
I'm sorry.
But I was like 4 months old.
Okay.
So
I'm sorry.
I was older than that. I was not a year old yet, though, when this episode aired.
I was 6 when this went off the air. So
yeah.
I think even then, this might... It probably wasn't scary.
This is the end of the run, though, I believe.
Yeah, this is one of the later episodes in their long, long run of 2 years.
Yeah. But it was a great setup. I mean, it's funny. I'd be interested to find why they segue, because the feel of the cartoon is so different than the movie. There's a lot of similarities, but it was very shocking to me because I used to watch this as a kid. I used to watch it in syndication. I loved the show. The movie is legitimately one of my favorite movies of all time. I adore the original. It's the reason, if people don't realize, why the song Jump on the Line by Harry Belafonte is on every Halloween playlist. It's a direct reference to this movie. It pops up on like Halloween fun playlists alongside the, you know, Friday the 13th theme song and stuff. But anyway, the feel is very different. It's much more whimsical. Beetlejuice and Lydia are not friends in the movie at all.
I have a confession. I have never seen the film Beetlejuice.
I have been working really hard in my life to be excited when people have not consumed media that I find really important, because then they just get to consume the media. It is my favorite Tim Burton movie by a long shot. Incredible performances, top to bottom. Young Alec Baldwin, what a snack. young Winona Ryder being every former Hot Topic shopping teenager's dream. Michael Keaton with, like, the most charming and disgusting performance as Beetlejuice. Danny Elfman's score, the aesthetic of Tim Burton. Like, it's iconic. It's such a good movie. So I would petition, even if it's post-Halloween, it's worth seeking out because it's great. And the show has got similarities, but yeah, Beetlejuice is like very much the charming antagonist of the entire movie. So him and Lydia being best friends is super bizarre in the cartoon.
That, from what I do understand of Beetlejuice, did not seem right. It was like, they're friends? All right, okay, I guess.
He forces Lydia to marry him at one point, or tries.
That's like friendship.
Except, like, way grosser. So the movie's great. The show is, I remember being very fun. I will say revisiting it and watching this episode. It's the same. It's like watching, like, Two and a Half Men or Big Bang Theory, where there were plot points. You're going to hit the exact same cadence every time. There's always going to be a setback. There's always going to be a solution. Like, it's not particularly innovative as far as a show or plot is concerned.
I remember watching this show, and I remembered not loving it, but I was like, we're older and we're wiser. We'll give it a fresh take. This show is, I don't think this show is very good.
That's fair. I mean, to each their own. I do think there's some stellar visual jokes and, like, small jokes thrown in. Now, granted, they ruin them by pointing at them, but there are some, in this episode in particular, there were a couple jokes that really got me until they pointed at them directly. I was like, all right, well, okay, that could have been fun and subtle, but... as a former, like, emo kid, the show is super, I watched this when I was a future, I was pre-emo kid, but I think it really teed me up for a beautiful future and wearing a lot of fishnet gloves.
Right, yeah. Like, Lydia's outfit, while in the neither world, is, like, some kind of spider cloak?
Yeah, it's kind of a take on the wedding dress she actually is forced to wear in the... It's a similar red kind of big thing, but it's a little gothy with spider webs all over it.
Huh.
And it's beautiful.
It's
an aesthetic I particularly love, but yeah, it was interesting to think about the video game. We've had a couple other, this is a trend actually, because we've watched a lot of cartoons because I love cartoons and I tend to want to pick them when I do screen watching. I feel like a lot of the video game episodes are set specifically in arcades.
Yeah, that comes up a lot.
Rather than with, like, a home console. Like,
yeah.
Regular show had a console. Like, a couple of them have had consoles, but it's mostly been arcades.
It feels like almost all of them have to use the game as, like, the complete driver of the plot. And a lot of times they have to explain the rules of the world because they're, like, not sure if people are going to get it.
Yeah. Well, and there's also that trope of play game, get sucked into game.
Yeah.
Which I remember most notably off the top of my head, the Fairly Odd Parents episode. That's the literal entire plot of that episode. Though it's VR rather than arcade, like an experiential arcade game. But there's definitely no innovation as far as, like, tropes or plot is concerned here.
Let's cover the plot briefly then. Yes. So, Lydia and Beetlejuice are playing games in Lydia's room at her house, and she's like, these games are too easy.
She's leet.
She is leet. She is getting a sponsorship from a chair company very mm-hmm. soon, and they'll have their logo on the back of the chair, and then, like, you'll always be able to see the logo of the chair when she's on stream.
Yeah, the chair will be red, and she'll get custom stitching that looks like spider webs, and then on her Twitch stream there will be a specific command for when she leaves that's like Lydia's chair streaming.
Yeah. What would be the name of her followers? Like, not like the spider mob, the cocoon crew,
The only thing I could think of was Black Widows, like you're watching the window, like instead of Widow. I'm not good at this. The Lydiogites. I got nothing.
Well, keep brainstorming. We'll get back to this.
Yeah, show up a fun handle. Who knows?
Yeah, yeah. So then Beetlejuice is like, I can show you some video games. I know video games. And then they go to the video games. They go to the Netherworlds video game arcade.
A great pun on Nether. It's neither here nor there. So I will say that is actually a reference. And if I remember correctly, they go to the Netherworld somewhat often in the show. So it is the afterlife. It is this weird, creepy mirror of regular terrestrial living life that is after you die that you go through. So there's like a whole bureaucracy. There's places to go. It's a large part of the plot of the Beetlejuice movie. Is two of the main three characters die at the very beginning, spoiler, but they literally die within the first like scene. And they have to go, they read their handbook of the deceased, and then they eventually have to go like punch a ticket at a municipal office to figure out what's happening. And there's another place, so that's where Beetlejuice gets summoned from. When you say his name three times, he gets summoned from that afterlifey, neither here nor there place, neither world, to come and generally terrorize people here on Earth.
But here he's only trying to help entertain, and
he's like a dorky dad the whole time. It's really weird.
He's offensive, but like completely like harmless.
Yeah, it's like fart joke sort of offensive. I want to go back and rewatch the first episode just to see what that transition from like, I attempted to force you to marry me so that I could stay on Earth and like enslave you essentially forever, to like, we're best friends.
And she's always very happy with all his jokes, and she's like, oh, Beej.
Yes, so many times does Lydia say Beej and BJ, which I guess just like was a thing that you could say in a children's show repeatedly. But I do think that that is legitimately why she uses the nickname, is because if she said it too many times, he would just disappear. She'd have to quickly say it to bring it back, and that would ruin everything. So,
yeah, that might have been like a point of friction at some point in their burgeoning relationship.
Good old Beej.
Jesus. So she spots a game. It's called Scourge. And she the cabinet opens up to the sound of the GoldenEye door opening sound effect.
Was that what it was?
I am 95% sure that's what it was.
That's awesome.
They repeat it later in the episode too, I think.
That's fantastic. That arcade cabinet looks amazing. You have to walk inside like a room with the light gun to play the game itself. I would totally play that.
There are a lot of those like these days, maybe not as much in the past, but like I went to Lucky Strike recently and they had all these different cabinets for like a Transformers game, a Jurassic Park game, Tomb Raider game. They were all like, get inside this giant cabinet and play.
I have very fond memories of playing the old Jurassic Park game where you like sat in a chair that rumbled as your Jeep drove through, where you shot dinosaurs, which I feel like was not the plot of Jurassic Park. But I played it with my dad at Chuck E. Cheese all the time when I was little. I loved that game. And like Time Crisis and stuff too, but this one was just like, it completely enclosed you in, not nefarious at all, seems very helpful and good and safe. But you know, Lydia's elite gamer and she needs to have only the hardest games.
And she's dominating really early on. Like she just kind of goes in there and she's just like beating up, shooting stuff with her zapper. They didn't bother to name it differently. That's called a zapper.
It's just straight up called a zapper. Apparently it's not trademarked at all. I will say, side note, as you're talking about this, like she was so good at her game at home that they needed to go to another plane of existence, and she was still insanely good at that video game. And I just kind of quietly love that Lydia is in fact elite gamer and is like really good at this stuff. And it's not, there's never once a joke or a comment about Lydia specifically being good at video games. It's just helpful and an accurate fact about her. Which is kind of cool.
It's nice, yeah.
I don't feel like other shows, even more recent ones, escape the trope of like, haha, girl. Maybe it's because she's a weird goth indoor kid, but like it's the thing that she's good at. I appreciated that it wasn't a thing.
because she's so good, it draws the attention of someone, and like she ends up getting dropped into the machine,
bringing her zapper with her on accident.
Yep. And just as Beetlejuice is realizing, oh wait, this machine, it might be an evil machine,
because it's in the evil plane of existence.
Yeah,
where all the dead people are. Yeah.
And she screams, and like, do you think they just used one scream over and over? Because I think she has the same scream every time.
Literally my only concrete, no answer, no debate complaint about this episode is how frequently Lydia screams at the top of her lungs. So much high-pitched screaming, it made me want to die. It does seem like, I hope to God for that voice actor's sake that they did not make her scream every single time.
I'm going to go with it was once. It was once, and they just reused it a bunch.
It sounds pretty much the same across the board. Maybe she's immaculate and can reproduce that same scream over and over again. But yeah, I really, really hope that she didn't have to do that once. Because that's the day that you do at your end of your week so that you don't ruin the rest of your week's gigs.
And when she lands in the game, she has to go through like this mesh. And okay, so the machine scans her appearance, and when she's playing it, she shows up like as she's dressed in the game. But then she enters the game and she has to wear a different costume.
Yes. And also she's like, it is the trope of like stuck in the game. If you don't beat the game, you're stuck here forever. It's magic. It's magic, right? It's
magic logic. Yeah, you know, it's magic. Because like a few minutes later, the evil thing is like, I'm going to use this diode on you, Beetlejuice. And that like causes his powers not to work. And it's like, okay, it's magic.
It's magic. It's Tron, but magic. Which like, sure, okay. Beetlejuice is also a demon that you can summon by saying his names three times. Like, sorry, Beege.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So like, friggin' whatever.
So they get in there and they're kind of tooling around with the different monsters. They're like playing a driving game.
Yeah, the different game sections that they had to do were super, super fun. She got a utility belt with a bunch of weapons, which was to me the best joke of the episode until they explained it, was the Uzi, which is a gun, but it just splurts goo out like very impotently on the ground because it's an Uzi. And I was like, all right, that's a visual pun I can get into.
Right.
Like, I'm not mad about it.
The whole setup for that part of the plot felt like it was done in such a way to make it take as long as possible.
Yeah, for sure. But it bummed me out because they set the joke up visually really early on as soon as she got her utility belt. Or I'm sorry, what they realized later was a futility belt. That's not nearly as good as the Uzi pun. But like they set up that joke. So if you were paying attention and you saw him hand her the Uzi, or she gets the Uzi, and then it goes blurmph. I'm like, that's hilarious. And then eventually it becomes a whole thing they have to point out directly because children are too dumb to understand jokes.
So the belt, Lydia gets the belt. She's like, I don't trust this guy. I don't think he's on the up and up. And then Beetlejuice gets into the game, and he's like, I don't trust this guy. I don't think he's on the up and up. And later on, she like takes out the belt, and so like she uses the one gun. I forget which one she uses first. The bazooka.
The bazooka, yeah, which just goes boo.
And it's a dud.
It's a dud. It doesn't do anything. All the guns are troll guns.
Yeah, so like they try the bazooka and it doesn't work. And then later in a separate crisis, when Beetlejuice needs help, she tries both the other guns.
Yeah.
And Beetlejuice is like, why did you do that? Obviously they weren't going to work. And she's like,
oh, the other one was a laser gun and it was like a lazy laser.
Right.
Or just like lazily, like a splurt of like, it looked like a hot glue gun stick just like fell out and like flumped on the ground. It's a good pun. Like, I do not fault the show for it. But yeah, it was a very weird choice of the reveals.
Yeah, that was like, I guess my main beef with all the gags is like they had to say everything they were going to do before they do it, or after they did it, they had to like make a joke about it.
Yeah, for sure. No, I'm with you on that. I mean, I think that's a lot of kids' shows, though, and I think especially kids' shows then, who apparently are cranking out 65-episode seasons, right? Like, they're not, I don't think they're going for a lot of nuance or trusting storytelling. But I do think it's a thing in cartoons that a lot of times they don't trust the kids to get their incredible jokes that they wrote.
I do want to call out the one joke that appeared to not be based on a visual gag or on a pun,
mm-hmm.
where they're getting chased by zombies and their car crashes. And then Lydia's like, Beetlejuice is like, zombies sure are stubborn. And Lydia says, yeah, I've noticed that about you guys. And Beetlejuice fires back, chill out, babe. We're stubborn, but sensitive, you know. And I was like, okay, that was kind of funny.
That's kind of funny. I also hate how much he calls her babe. He does in the movie, but it's creepy in the movie. Now it's like this affectionate term. That and the other joke that got me was, so in the arcade, the guy that runs the arcade, who would normally be the coin guy you'd go to and he could give you change. And this is why I love the aesthetic of Tim Burton-y type stuff. He opens up his whole head like a Pez dispenser and pulls coins out of his neck. And so at the end, there's a conflict and they're having a thing. And Beetlejuice says, like, I'll flip you for it. Like, flip a coin. And he just picks up and flips the dude upside down. And it's just like, that's dumb. And I'm very happy about it. But yeah, no, I mean, most of them were pretty hard telegraph jokes that could have been like subtle little touches for people paying attention or for smart kids rather than like billboarded.
There's one that I really wanted to point out, and we'll get to it, I think, pretty soon.
Yeah, I skipped ahead, but that just made me chuckle while I was getting ready this morning watching this episode when he flipped the whole dude. I was like, this is absurd. I'm so happy it's happening.
So yeah, I mean, this follows the same plot as most of these type of trapped in a video game things. They play through the different challenges. They survive. At one point, they zap a hole in a wall. They walk to the other side of the wall, see there's nothing there, and then just like fall down into a hole anyway for no reason I can tell.
you could, Bill?
Yes?
You could say it was a plot hole. Ha-ha! The pun has become the punner.
That was pretty good.
Yeah, I know. It was really good.
That was pretty
good. Yeah, this is to make up for the fact that I couldn't think of a Lydia Twitch situation. All right, I'll see myself out.
Thank you your contributions to the podcast.
I've been fired permanently.
At a certain point in there, they get separated. Lydia's trying to like fight like 20 people while Beetlejuice runs around.
Mostly successfully fighting them. Her zapper dies, but even still, like, she's doing pretty okay.
Still felt like a strange delegation of duties, because, like, Beetlejuice is like, I don't understand electronics. And Lydia's like, okay, here, go do the thing that it requires electronics. I'm going to go here and fight these things.
Right, exactly. He is known for being able to change into other things. He doesn't really do it in this episode, I don't think. But he can, like, change into, he was a sandworm, he can change into stuff. But sure, yeah, let Lydia fight.
Right.
Let the small child fight.
And while Beetlejuice is running around trying to find the correct and or gate, he...
Which I feel like that's a thing, right? Like, that feels like a reference. It felt like a real thing.
I think it's like a real, like a computational thing.
Yeah, I feel like someone involved in the script did attempt to put some, like, programmer Easter eggs in. But I don't know anything about it, so I didn't actually get them. But I heard that, and I was like, that seems like a thing. That doesn't seem like a construct for...
Right.
Because they make a joke with it, but I was like, this isn't built for a joke.
And he runs, though, into Daddy Eddie. And at the earlier on, the arcade operator was like, yeah, there's this guy, Daddy Eddie, and he used to play the game, and then he disappeared. And they find Daddy Eddie in the machine.
Hooray.
Yeah.
The zombie boy lives.
And he says...
Technically.
He says that he is okay, but he can't get out because he can't remember the password to the system? Something?
Sure.
He can't remember.
To Scourge. To the physical embodiment of Scourge. Sure. Yeah.
So Beetlejuice is like, all right, you stay here. I'm going to try and figure this out. He goes and meets up with Lydia, and they play what they call a game of word association.
I do think this was actually really clever. Because the whole premise is that the computer can't be wrong. Like, it doesn't mess up. It has to give... It's going to give the right answer. Because it anticipates moves that they make at certain times. So the word association is a way of making him... Getting Tim comfortable. And then... Making him associate password with the actual password.
Yeah. Scourge gives up the actual password in a move that's prescient of many jokes in modern media. The password is enter.
Yes, of course. If it was only password. I think it's a little early internet and early time for that. But it's that same. It's the same joke construction or same idea construction of like jokes that make you think words that rhyme over and over again and then trick you into saying something wrong or something. Like, I'm not going to recount that joke on your podcast because it's both not good and boring, but there's it's a joke construction of like associate, say the thing you're not supposed to say.
Aren't you glad we're not going to do the whole joke?
That's not the one that I meant, but yes, I'm very glad.
Now, even though they have the password, they still haven't escaped for reasons. So they have to go and like actually beat up Scourge to get out.
I have no idea what the password accomplished.
It really wasn't clear. Like, Scourge was like, "Arg!" And then they were like, oh no, we still have to like run through this door. And
then I guess they unlocked the final door, maybe? Unlocked the door to run through the final doors?
I guess it wasn't.
It's not great. It's not airtight.
So they finally directly confront Scourge, and they realize they have to give them a computer virus. So Beetlejuice wads up a hanky that he did sneeze on before. So they could have just used that. But then they had him blow his nose again. He throws it. And when he throws it, he says, strike three, you're out of the game, that is.
Yeah. I mean, listen, it's not good. It's another pun. I don't think I realized when I was watching it, because I just was sort of absorbing them as they came, the volume of puns. Like that is the only joke mechanism in the entire show, pretty much, minus the one that you pointed out. It's a lot of puns.
It's a lot. I feel like they're firing them out there quite often.
Maybe it's a good method to teach children about like colloquial language.
Yeah.
That's me being really optimistic. I think they just liked puns.
It was ahead of its time. Like, they had that one show, like, Science Court on CBS, where, like, Paula Poundstone is a judge, and they, like, talk about science. This was ahead of its time, though. This was ahead of that.
Oh, my God. Can we watch an episode of that show next time? That sounds awesome.
Sure.
Paula Poundstone rules. There's probably one about video games.
There's probably, yeah. I'll look it up.
Seriously, we'll now I legitimately want to look up this show. That sounds amazing.
It's real. It's a thing.
You don't hear that mention. I feel like I hear Bill Nye and Beakman's World. Beakman's World? Is that right?
Yes, Beakman's World, yes. Bill Nye. Yeah.
I never watched Beakman's World. I always remember the section of our comics
Beakman! Page.
Yeah, I watched Bill Nye.
Oh, I didn't have to watch Bill Nye to know about Bill Nye. Believe it. With a guy with a first name of Bill and a last initial N.
That's fair. I got Shelby Woo from the Mystery Files of Shelby Woo for a long time. Doesn't help that she was Asian and I'm Asian-ish. So I got lots of asking if I could melt into... No, that was Clarissa.
That was Alex Mack.
Oh my God. Good era, but so many shows. It's been a long day. But yes, I got asked if I solved mysteries a lot.
Then did you say, nah, 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 nah?
I didn't. I mostly just cried because I was being made fun of.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's much darker.
Which is weird because she's like cool. Anyway, it's not important.
They get out of the machine, and it turns out, in a twist that honestly didn't seem necessary, Daddy Eddie was the one controlling the machine the whole time.
It also didn't make any sense, period. Like, did he program it originally? Did he, when he used the password, he took over, and then he was playing dumb?
He said he invented the machine and then sold it to the arcade owner.
And then got himself stuck in it.
And spread the rumor that he had disappeared?
But he was in the game. So it wasn't a rumor. He literally was stuck in the game.
But, like, who would tell? If he entered the game, who was going to be the person that says, like, by the way, Daddy Eddie disappeared?
I mean, that... Well, because the guy, the arcade owner, did not seem concerned. He was like, I haven't seen him in a while. Didn't put two and two together.
And presumably, other people have tried this machine and died. I mean, it's a neither world. But...
I will say, I actually think that is not true, because there is... Scourge is very clear that Lydia is special because she's so good at video games that she is a worthy opponent. Now, he gives her nothing but borked weapons, and it doesn't seem like the idea is that she'll ever beat anything. So I think he just likes to torture true gamers.
That seems on point, honestly.
Well, fair, and also fair. But he makes it clear more than once that, like, she's a worthy opponent rather than, like, And this machine sucked up 27 children recently.
So, as always, Shelby, we rate this on three different categories. And like with any good video game, it's scored on a scale of 6 to 10. So we're going to start out with accuracy as our first category. So if you thought this was completely inaccurate to real video games, give it a 6. If you found it to be extremely lifelike accurate, give it a 10.
So, I mean, so the answer's 6, right? Like, you go into the video game. We had this debate on previous episodes where it's like, go into video game, right? That's not accurate. However, I will say, I feel like it gets some cred for Lydia and, like, the, A, seeking out harder and harder games and, like, seeking out different challenges and the, like, flippant, cool, too good for this, like, tough game or trying to show off in this thing that's not actually that impressive feels very honest to me. So I'm going to give it, like, a 7. I'm going to give it an extra point for that. Also, there were some good, like, video game references. The arcade had some fun references and things that felt like it was an arcade in another space where undead and zombie people lived.
I would give it a 7 as well. I think, like, in even by my punishing rubric, there are points at the beginning of the episode where they're playing real games or games that seem realistic, and, like, they're doing it in her room with her TV, which seems, like, true to a teenager having their own TV and, like, all their games hold up in their room.
And so, that there'd be an appeal to go to an arcade for a game that you, like, couldn't play at home or that might be super hard or cost a bunch to play a bunch.
Yes, for 1991, that would still be appropriate.
Yeah, for sure.
For modern people, that, yeah, that's pretty much true. I would not go to a VR cafe. You do not know where those headsets have been.
But if I play Beat Saber at home, I will break everything. My apartment is so small, and they have a VR set. I will say, DDR also, not the same at home. You have to play it in arcade.
It's fair. It's fair.
Or you could be like me and buy the pad to play at home with your PlayStation, and then duct tape it to a large piece of plywood so it doesn't slip around on the carpet.
Tell me you have that right now.
I don't anymore. It's back in Maryland. That actually legitimately might be somewhere in my dad's house. It's going to be really good sound on the podcast. It's just as impressive. And upsetting is more than impressive.
Okay.
Yes, that was real life story from young Shelby.
Next up is condescension. So if you found this to be completely uncondescending towards gamers, give it a 6. If you found it to be extremely condescending, give it a 10.
I'm going to rate this high, actually, because I think even though the jokes weren't good, I do feel like they were people written by people that play video games and, like, are either poking fun or just writing within their culture. They're just writing bad jokes within that space. Like, I didn't find it condescending. Also, Lydia is the hero throughout, and she is the gamer, right? Like, she is the person good at games, and she's good throughout. So I'm going to give this a 9.
So it's...
No, flip it.
Yeah,
7.
Yeah, it's weird because I didn't think about it when I set the scales.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
It's too late to...
No, condescension. No.
So
I'm just dumb.
It's not condescending.
It's not condescending. I'll give it a 6.5.
Just
to apologize for putting it on the wrong side of the spectrum.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, I would have to go with a 7. I thought it was pretty much treated gaming as, like, this a normal thing to do. Lydia does it, and really, like you pointed out, no one ever, like, comments on the fact that she's doing it. She just goes and plays the game, and the arcade manager's like, okay, play the game. And Daddy Eddie plays the game, and Beetlejuice is like, I like the games. He's like, I'm not good at the games, but I like the games.
He likes watching the games.
Yeah.
Proto Twitch.
See, yeah, he's a viewer.
Yeah.
He would definitely be subscribed to Lydia's stream.
He'd be sending bits to Lydia, for sure.
Way too many bits. Uncomfortable messages in chat.
Doesn't,
like, I love you so much, Lydia.
I was going to say, that is the name of your podcast. Not way too many bits, but too many. But yes, yeah, oh, 100%. He would be the sort of dude that would be upset that when he found out that she got a boyfriend because he had been sending her so many bits and had stayed sub to her for 14 months, and why wasn't she in love with him?
Yeah, she would, yeah, get some nasty DMs. That is the consequence of so many bits.
That would come right after lewd pictures. Oh, no, I've set it off again. It's like the worst cat.
Lastly is entertainment. If you found this to be... If you found this to be completely unentertaining, give it a 6. If you found it to be completely entertaining, give it a 10.
So maybe this is the nostalgia. It's not the nostalgia. 10. Screw you. This episode ruled. I love this show. It's stupid, and it makes me very, very happy. It's nostalgia mostly.
I'm going to give this a 6.5.
Yeah, I figured.
The half point is for the one joke I thought was funny, and the fact that Lydia's voice actor went on to portray Jubilee in the X-Men cartoon of the early 90s.
Glitter lights.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think Jubilee existed before that. She was like a new character for that show.
Oh, that's right. She was.
And she, yeah. I never understood why she wore a raincoat. Like, it looks like she's wearing a raincoat all the time.
Yeah, but that was like cool in the 90s. Was like it? A street fashion-y type thing, yeah. She was pretty, she was actually pretty explicitly, her style was very explicitly like young, hip, street fashion-y type thing from the 90s. And so that kind of, because it was also at a period where a lot of fashion culture was being influenced by the rise of stardom of athletic, of athletes being stars rather than just like movie theater or movie stars and stuff. And so a lot of street fashion and stuff was deeply influenced by athletic wear. So like that kind of silky raincoaty type jacket was very much like a warm-up jacket style. I just watched an episode of a show on the history of athleisure. So that's where I learned that. But yeah, I think that's probably why. Or it's going to rain.
Maybe it is.
All the time.
She hangs out with Storm a lot.
That's true. Maybe it's a precautionary measure.
And Storm, you know, if things get hot, Storm's going to be like, let's lightning bolt this place up, you know?
Yeah.
So maybe she's just a little more prudent than her other teammates who don't pack a raincoat. Never thought about that before. Good point, Shelby.
Yes, I definitely made that point on purpose. She's the most rational of the X peoples. So I knew you weren't going to give this a high rating on this. I will say, do not let this deter you from seeing the movie, because the movie is very, very different and so much better than the show. I love the show, but I love a stupid kids cartoon, and I have a lot of nostalgia because I loved it and I love the movie and I like the aesthetic a lot. But do not let it deter you from watching the movie. It's very good.
It'll go on the list. There's a lot of movies. I just don't see many movies at all.
That's 100% true. We just missed the perfect season. We're like, oh, and I feel like when you're in a right season and there's a theme to the season, it's fun to watch a movie in that theme because it feels like part of like the decoration or a celebration or whatever. And I'm more inclined to watch movies because of that. So, I don't know. Maybe come over and I'll cook you a weird, like, creepy themed dinner and we can hang out and watch Beetlejuice.
That sounds fun. Yeah. Nice. All right. Free dinner.
Oh, no, you have to pay for it.
Oh.
This friendship isn't free. You sound like Tina, which makes me like the sound more, which is upsetting.
We'll be right back with an interview. We are back from break. Joining me once again from this palatial study room in the Harold Washington Library in downtown Chicago is David Antignoli. David is an assistant professor of game design at Columbia College Chicago. He was recently on the podcast when we were doing the playtest night over at Chicago's Logan Theater, and I'm really glad to have him back on. David, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So normally, this would be an opportunity for like a guest to talk about the game they're working on. We talk to a lot of independent game designers on the show, but for you, maybe this would be a good chance to pitch the course that you teach at Columbia. Would you be able to give like a 1 to 2 minute summary of the course and like the syllabus of what goes on there?
Yeah, I can give you a summary, but you better stop me when it starts to get too long, because I'm used to, our classes are 3 hours each, so I found that I can just, once I get going, it goes. So I work primarily with the game design major at Columbia, and In my role, I instruct a whole lot of different classes. This semester, I teach the Intro to Game Dev course, which, like, all of our freshmen, no matter whether they're going to be an artist, a programmer, a designer, a sound designer, etc., will have to take that class. And I'm also teaching story development for interactive media this semester. And then I'm also teaching the independent game studio capstone, which is like the seniors will build their own indie games as part of their senior capstone.
Now, to be able to teach, I mean, you certainly have to be able to do at some point. And you've been in the industry now. You're a veteran of about a decade, having made games with various studios around the U.S. Can you tell us a little bit about your background there?
Yeah, let's see. So I got started, I guess, as a grad student at Indiana University. And really the only reason I went to grad school back then was because when I was in undergrad, there wasn't really such a prevalent, there weren't so many like game design programs back then. And so I knew I wanted to do game design, but there weren't a whole lot of easy ways to learn how to do it. And so when I graduated undergrad, I was an English major, and also at Indiana, they had a individualized major program where you could kind of build your own major, and it was awesome for me. I got to take like all kinds of interesting classes and like a variety of subjects, but there was really no one there who had worked in the game industry who could sort of tell me what you were supposed to do to get in. And I didn't really understand how tough it was going to be, and once I graduated, I started to figure that out quick, and I realized that what you need is a strong portfolio. And so I was very fortunate to be able to go to grad school at IU and teach there, which basically paid for it, so I didn't have to go into more debt. And during that time, there still wasn't anyone really there who had been in the game industry, but there was another student I met who had built his own game engine. His name is Victor Chelleru, and he still runs this engine today. It's called Flat Red Ball. It's at this point, it's like primarily a 2D game engine. It's open source. I really recommend you check it out. I'm about to start a project with him soon to make like a monthly game. We can talk about that later if you want. But anyhow, that's really when I started making games, because like the key to getting into the game industry is building a portfolio of games that you've made. And you know, like I said, back then there was no such thing as like Unity or Unreal that was easily obtained publicly and free. So it was really confusing and tough to figure out, am I supposed to just like make my own game engine with C++? What's going on here? And so Vic had introduced me to his game engine and helped me make two pretty crappy student games. One was about a telekinetic robot. It was like a side scroller where you could click on physics objects, kind of like if you played Trine, like the wizard in Trine. The other was like a top-down co-op twin stick shooter thing. It was called Stanley Frost Demon Fire Hunter. I think some of these videos are still on YouTube.
Stanley Frost is the first name. Yeah. Demon Fire is the middle name?
Demon Fire Hunter.
Demon Fire Hunter.
The idea behind that was kind of like to match the rhythm of a title, sort of like Phoenix Wright : Ace Attorney, Stanley Frost, Demon Fire Hunter. Anyway, they were goofy games, but they were good enough. Then I went to GDC and showed off my work to as many people as I could, and was able to get a handful of interviews and a couple of job offers. And the one I wound up taking brought me to Chicago to High Voltage Software in the suburbs at Hoffman Estates. So that's really when I started making full-on commercial games for a salary. There's one more thing I did before that, I guess, now that I remember. One of my professors, Lee Sheldon, when I was at IU in grad school, he did a ton of contract writing jobs or game design jobs, really. He would write like this whole huge game design document and then send it to basically these like Russian or Eastern European outsourcers to basically make the game he wrote, which was really weird and interesting. But he was kind enough to allow me and a couple other students to kind of work. So what I was doing was, these games had branching dialogue, like tons of branching dialogue. They're adventure games, Agatha Christie, Hercule Poirot type stuff. And so we would be in charge of logic checking the dialogue flow charts, the puzzle design, that kind of stuff. And that's how I got my first credit on a console game. And then at High Voltage, my first game was Dora the Explorer. Dora Saves the Snow Princess. So so that wasn't exactly my dream job, but I was getting a real salary to make games at that point, so I was pretty happy.
As part of your like your education, the things you try and impart on students, is it part of like just the building yourself up in the industry in addition to just the techniques on how to make a game?
The way I try to advise them is like, they, you know, a ton of getting into the game industry is kind of marketing yourself. I mean, that's sort of what a portfolio ultimately is. It's like marketing your own work. So I try to have them emphasize presenting their own work as professional and not as like student projects. So not so much like, sometimes I'll get projects where they're named like Project 2. I'm like, nope, don't call it Project 2. Call it like Cosmic War, Stanley Frost, Demon Fire Hunter, or something dumb like that. And just, you know, give it all the trimmings of a real professional game. And that kind of stuff goes a long ways towards, you know, hitting that ever elusive criteria of like X amount of shipped titles that you'll see in like every job listing. That's always one of the more stressful ones for students. It's like, how do I get into the industry if one of the requirements is that I'm already in the industry shipping titles? And really, it's not, people don't really care if your game sold like 100,000 copies. They just want to see good work. So if you present a real game that actually got finished, where you actually did a lot of the good work in it, that basically counts.
I mean, I think you've seen some of this professional maturation among your own students, right? Because last year, E3 2018, some of your students at Columbia, they worked on Kakute Koyo, and they took that to E3 as part of the finalists of a contest. Is that right?
Yeah, they won or at least selected as finalists in out of all of the college students in the U.S. to show their game at E3 last year. so that was super exciting. And yeah, I think you know, actually the first time they showed their game was at the Logan Theater last year, and then then later, you know, not that much longer, you know, that was in November. Then come May or June, they're showing their game in Los Angeles at E3. So that is a big jump, and I think it helps. You know, when you know you're gonna present your work at a serious show like that, it really makes you serious about the work, and you try extra hard. And so it's always awesome to have those kinds of opportunities for students to show their work to a bigger audience, because it really motivates them and turns them on and gets them going at a high level.
Do you have any of your own E3 memories? Like, I know at a certain point a decade ago, like, they were going through like kind of an upheaval where they were like gonna shut E3 down, and they brought it back, and it mostly got back to where it once was.
Yeah, I mean, so as a kid, I would always read Nintendo Power. So we're talking 80s and 90s, I guess. And so I would always see E3 presented in those magazines as like this awesome, amazing thing. It was like one of my huge goals to go to. And this was before really you could like get online and see all the same stuff. Or even now we have these, you know, what do they call it? The Game Awards have this new thing where you can play the games.
I
forget what it's called.
Yeah, like you can demo the games on Steam for 48 hours.
So now it's like not a big deal, I feel like. You don't have to wait in line. You can just get on your computer and play it. But back then it was like, oh my God, this is the only way to try out like the new Zelda game is at E3. So it was a huge goal of mine to get there. And so I was fortunate enough to catch an E3 year when it was still, well, like you said, there has kind of been like a seesaw nature to it. But I was able to present on one of the big years, so it was probably like 2011, I want to say. And I was there for Sega because they were the publisher of our game Conduit 2. And yeah, it was really cool. I mean, like, even when you walked into the show, they were giving out copies of Nintendo Power. It had our game in it. So for me, that was like a huge full circle moment of accomplishment. Now I think Nintendo Power is like a YouTube series or something. But it was really rewarding to have my game in the magazine. And E3 was fun. It's weird. I never realized that. So my understanding, they kind of prepped me a lot for this, is that the point of the show is to show your game to these quote-unquote buyers who basically represent the big box stores. And if they like what they see, they order more of your game to like have when it comes out on their store shelves. So it used to be really important on that level. But again, now as stuff is moving more towards digital, I have to imagine it's less of a big deal. But it was certainly fun. You're in LA, you get to do all kinds of playtests and interviews and talk to all kinds of famous industry people. And there was like a professional wrestling stage behind our game because there was some pro wrestling game that had come out. And so that was really wild. Like people getting slammed around right behind while you're trying to talk to, I don't know, it was wild. But yeah, it was fun. I'm glad I got to do it. I don't know. I was not able to go with my students last summer because back then I was only part-time, and so there was no travel budget for part-time instructors. So hopefully we win again and I can go back.
Yeah. Now, you know, since you have started out working in the game industry, teaching these classes, the way games are made has grown and changed in so many ways. I mean, the engines that people use, the techniques, certainly, I have to imagine, have changed. How do you stay up to date on these developments as they keep coming and coming and coming?
It's not easy. I can tell you for a while I was... So if we were to just only talk about Unity, which is such a small slice of the whole game industry, right? But even just within that small slice, it's still constantly evolving. For a while, I was working as a contract writer for Microsoft, basically writing documentation and samples about how to use Microsoft products with Unity. And the pace of the documents becoming outdated was really tough to deal with. I mean, like, it was really wild. Like, as a user, as a developer, I normally stayed away from all the betas and stuff like that that you can access. But if you pay attention to all that stuff, you'll see the pace of new features is crazy. And if you want to stay on top, you just have to keep learning. Luckily, there's a ton of online resources and good documentation, like I was paid to do, to make that a little easier. But you know, at the end of the day, all of the new technology is just making it simpler to do bigger and better things. So even though it is a little frustrating to be like, shit, now the whole way Unity's dealing with input has changed, like I'm gonna have to, you know, not only learn that myself, but then change the way I teach it, and that will only last for like so long before it all changes again. So it can be frustrating, but in the end, I'm happy for it because it just empowers us to do better stuff.
Does that apply to the games you play as well? I mean, just as a fan myself, like I think about, do people even use like DualShocks when they're young anymore? Like, do they just use tablets and you know, stuff like that?
Well, you know, there's like a, I will say, as an instructor, I see a lot of, I guess, younger generations, right? And so far, it's definitely still most of them, you know, granted, they're all like 18 and over, But they're mainly still in a controller type mindset, if not mouse and keyboard. I think for them, it's mainly, you know, yeah, DualShock 4 and maybe a little bit of Xbox One. But I suspect as times change, we'll see more people who are more instinctively want to do stuff with motion control or fit more physical control, touch control, all that. So it is interesting.
Do you have to update your frame of reference on the games that people play? Like, I mean, Fortnite, I imagine Fortnite is very popular, but I don't know for sure.
Actually, so I think that's interesting. One thing, I always try to perceive like what they're all excited about. So it used to be like, I don't know, if there's ever going to be like a Smash Brothers game that comes out, they're all excited about it when it comes out. I remember another big one was Fallout, I guess Fallout 4 it would have been. Everyone was really excited about it, and then it kind of like didn't live up to expectations. Another one was Destiny, same thing. I had to have so many students I had to yell at to shut up about getting hyped for Destiny, and then it came out and I never really heard them talk about it again. And I feel like the big mega hits, the major touchstones that everybody knows, are becoming fewer and farther between. Maybe part of it is because everybody is playing the same game longer. Like, you know, there's no end to what's the one you just mentioned that Epic makes? Fortnite, right? Yeah. There's no end to that. There's no end to League of Legends. So people are playing these for longer and maybe not so much interested in the new stuff. But I also just think it's because there's so many new games out there that, and the pace of them is much faster, that it's harder for any one game to just totally dominate the market like that. We talked a little about this earlier. Like, it's interesting that, well, some of my go-to examples that I guess it kind of dates you. You're like, all right, let's talk about Ocarina of Time. Like, obviously you have to know about that because, like, it gets re-released and everybody still likes Zelda. Or maybe even, like, Breath of the Wild now is a new one. But you'd be surprised. You might make an assumption that everybody's played Breath of the Wild, so you can make an example from that, and, like, maybe half the class has. Or another go-to for me used to be Mass Effect. I would at least assume they played, like, Mass Effect 2 or something like that. Anymore, it's, like, not so much. One of the last ones I can bank on is Witcher 3. Like, okay, how can I relate this to Witcher 3? But it's interesting. It's becoming harder to track these major touchstones. And so one thing I'm going to start doing, because I've realized that they're not, I don't know what they're playing so much anymore, is I want to try and figure out a way to create like a poll. Like, if you could have your professors play one game, like, pick it, and whichever one gets the most votes, at least I'll play. I guess I can't make anyone else do it, but I think that'll be an interesting way to see what they at least think their professors should play. And then hopefully, my hope is that I've already played it.
I mean, when you think about it, assuming the average child maybe starts playing video games around 5, and then you add 13 years to that, that means like most kids were starting with like the Wii now, like maybe the 360 is like the first thing they ever touched. One of those two.
Yeah, I see a lot of GameCube still, and every once in a while I hear kids talk about like Nintendo 64, but a lot of them it's like, one of their earliest games would be like Halo or Paper Mario. A lot of them I hear talk about, like, when I was a kid, we played Paper Mario. And of course they're talking about the one on GameCube, Thousand Year Door, whatever it's called. But that I see
not changed. Even the original Paper Mario, yeah,
right, that's cool, yeah. Yeah. And it's that does change really perceivably fast, and it kind of makes you feel old.
Now, with these kids who are coming in, they're all obviously very passionate about video games, but, you know, there have got to be some of them who they've, like, maybe in high school, they already made their own game and it's up on itch. And then maybe there are other kids who are like, I liked Paper Mario. Maybe I can make my own game. How do you like reconcile the different levels of experience that exist between the students here?
It's hard. It's one of the hardest parts of the job is to kind of deliver the crushing reality of like how tough it is to make games, how tough it is to get into the game industry. A lot of them are there just because they like playing games and they aren't sure necessarily that they actually are interested in developing the games. And so really one of the, you know, the best course of action is to, for me, at least in my opinion, is like get them started developing stuff right away and understanding all of the kind of painstaking labor that's involved and how hard it is to evaluate scope. Like a lot of their ideas for games that like incoming freshmen will have would be like ideas for, you know, JRPGs that are like 120 hours long or like, you know, crazy multiplayer things that would require $1 million budgets in like 4 years and a team of like 80 people. And I'm like, there's one of you and you don't know how to make games yet and you want to graduate in 4 years. So we need to start like dialing it back. And that's always a tough thing to swallow and to really learn. I mean, I feel like I'm still misjudging scope to this day. So I know that's hard. And then, you know, regarding the different skill levels, that's very difficult to navigate in class too. One thing I try to do is be a little open-ended. Like if someone is very, you know, luckily at Columbia, we have relatively small class sizes, like in the 10 to 20 range for your average class that I would teach. And that allows me some leeway to kind of help students work at their own pace, which is nice. So you don't feel like you're necessarily like hamstringing someone who's really like, I don't want to hold someone back who's really like ready to go to the next level. I can give them kind of their own thing to do while I make sure that everyone else is learning the fundamentals, you know.
You know, I just realized that we're talking a lot about your work as a teacher, but that hasn't precluded you from making your own games. You're still active in the game development community, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, once I finished at High Voltage, I kind of had soured on the lack of creative control that your average person in the ranks of the game industry would have. You know, not everybody is like going to be able to be the Kojima like auteur who gets to call the shots, creative director type. You know, there's one of them, and then there's like 200 of everybody else. And so I wasn't really interested in indie games. Like, let's give this a shot for a while and see how it goes. And that is a tough market. You know, I think that's one of the perceptions that might be out there, because most of the indie games that we know are like the success stories, but there are so many indie games out there that you may not see that are really struggling to tread water financially. And so that's kind of how I got into teaching, as like a way to bankroll the indie games on the side. So I've been developing all throughout teaching. One of the cool things about being a professor is that roughly my duties are split into three categories. Teaching is the big one, and then service to the college is another. But then the last one that's really fun and rewarding for me is creative practice. So part of my job is to keep making stuff and staying current and being well known. So that's a fun goal.
I recommend for listeners, on a recent episode, David and I, we talked about his VR game, TP. do you think you're going to have that anywhere else demoing for the Chicago area?
Well, I would love to. I think, sadly, the amount of opportunities to show games locally is kind of few and far between. And that's one of my goals, is to try and work on that problem. So I know we have like BitBash, and there's a few peripheral related BitBash events. We have that the Logan Playtest Party in November. And there's just really not a ton of other things. There's like an IGDA show tonight that I'll go to, so that's cool. Mm-hmm. But I was actually, so one of my goals is to create a bit of a venue for showing indie games and indie experiences, I guess, indie game-like experiences. And I was actually chatting with someone at the Logan playtest party who had a really great metaphor for it. It's like, if you want to go see indie music, you could go to like the Empty Bottle, but basically any night, and any number of other music venues in Chicago. If you want to go check out some indie games, some local indie games, there's like, you just can't do that except for like on a few nights of the year. So I would love to show TP more. I have no idea when the next opportunity will be to do that. So yeah.
If you'd like the full story on TP and the secret meaning behind that name, check out that previous episode. I guess my final serious question for you is, do you see yourself continuing to walk this dual path like 5 years from now? Have you had time to think about that far down the road?
Well, again, one of the nice things about being a professor is there's actually like a pretty clear ladder to climb in terms of career development. And so for me, I'm on tenure track, and basically I have to keep making stuff and teaching for 5 years to get tenure. So I do definitely see myself still doing it. And that was part of the calculus for sure. I mean, like I wanted to figure out a way to not be so stressed out about finding the next contract. You know, when you're working as a freelancer and a contractor, and then also trying to do your own personal creative projects on the side, it's pretty stressful. There's no steady paycheck. You know, some months are way better than others. So I was really looking for something more stable that also still afforded me the ability to work on creative stuff. So I'm pretty happy, and I think in the foreseeable future I will stay on this path.
Okay, then in that case, I have two final questions for you. So this one, the first one here, this was brought to my attention on Twitter by at Dracula Voice. So I'm just going to read to you the question verbatim. Has anyone really been far, even as decided to use even go want to do look more like?
What? I don't know what that means.
Back when the first conduit was being previewed, there's a image from 4chan where it's like a picture of a screenshot of the conduit, and someone's like talking about the different graphical effects that have been applied to it, and then this was the reply to that screenshot.
That's awesome. Yeah, I don't know. I guess that one must have flew under my radar while I was working there, which is somehow surprising because obviously we, you know, there were a lot of people following all of these social media threads.
I can appreciate if you're staying off 4chan, though. In fact, I would encourage most people on the job at High Voltage to stay off 4chan.
Yeah, that's just good advice in general, I suppose. Yeah.
And lastly, so, I mean, you're already familiar. I ask a question about Pokemon to conclude these podcasts, but I already asked you about which one I believe you'd like as a pet. So it wouldn't really be fair if I asked you that again. So instead, what I'd like to know is, of all the Pokemon out there and all the different regions and all the different evolutions, which one would be the best student?
Huh.
Doesn't have to be a game design student either. It could be just like a, you know, someone who just generally is diligent and goes to class.
This is like testing my encyclopedic knowledge of Pokemon, which is very, very rusty. Even though I am playing the new one, there's like, you know, obviously a lot that aren't in it. I don't know. I feel that it would probably be like, you know, one of the psychic ones, because they normally make them seem smart with big brains and stuff like that. So I don't know, but perhaps a funny choice would be like Psyduck. I feel like Psyduck is a maybe not the best ideal student, but it's a realistic one.
Constantly vexed, frustrated, and not fully understanding what's going on.
Yeah, hopefully that doesn't sound too mean. I don't mean that in a mean way. I mean that in an endearing way.
As someone who's only ever been a student, I can relate. So, yeah, Psyduck is a fine choice. Well, David, I think that brings our interview to a close. Before I let you go, though, is there a place you want people to find you, like online, if you want to stay in touch?
I guess on Twitter, it's just at David Antognoli. It's Antognoli is my last name. And then most of my game stuff is at nightcitygames.com. So those are two good spots, I suppose.
Great. Awesome. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And we're back from break. One more time, big thank you for this week's interview. We are about to head out, but we have one more thing that needs to be taken care of. It's your favorite thing, Shelby. It's your favorite part of the episode. You're always asking when you can come back on so we can talk about this some more.
It's just because I like rolling dice. And I hope so. I've never hoped to crit fail more in my life. What are you going to do if I roll a one?
Well, you get to roll three times, so I'll get
what
at least...
What if I roll three ones? It's statistically possible.
Then, you know, that's how much magic there was meant to be.
3 seconds. The proper amount.
Savage.
Yeah, that was harsh.
We're going to talk about magic here with Bill's Magic Minute. So I am a big fan of the game Magic the Gathering, but to keep it from leaking out into the rest of the podcast, I limit myself to a randomly selected amount of time, somewhere between 3 seconds and 60 seconds by rolling 3d20. And Shelby, you said you were going to take care of that for us this week?
Yeah. Okay, so I guess if I have to, I'm going to make a dice sound while I roll it on an app on my phone. Because I'm that guy that has a dice rolling app on my phone.
That works for me. That was one roll when you didn't do that?
This is going to be terrible for the podcast. Oh, this is fantastic. So I rolled a 13, a 3, and a 1.
Oh,
you have 17 seconds. This is great. I love this segment.
Started off so well with a 13.
Actually, the first one was a 3. I was just trying to build tension.
Oh.
All right, you have 17 seconds. Okay. I'll count you down at the end.
So my topic for this week is the playtest cards. So I'm ready to start when you are.
Okay. 3, 2, 1.
The Mystery Booster playtest cards were such a fun idea to include with those convention editions. It's strange to me that they have not put those into the conventional packs, that they, first of all, preferred there would be foils there for people, and that, second of all, Mark Rosewater would be so opposed. Oh, okay, we're done. Well, yeah, I got the sign. Sorry, folks. Let's talk about it more.
What does Mark think?
Mark who?
Doesn't matter. I don't care.
Okay, thank you. See, other guests are more accommodating, and they'll ask me follow-up questions because they are curious about the things I like.
I have tried on previous episodes, and you've been like, nope, we're done, so now I'm just going to maintain that universe that you've built in which magic is verboten unless I'm talking about them using Twitch lingo around it.
It's true, yeah. I did talk about magic. Okay, good point. We did talk about magic indirectly earlier with the Twitch lingo, so yeah, I've already overstepped. I'm sorry, folks. I understand if you want to leave a 1-star review on the iTunes store, do it, because honestly, I believe the algorithm just checks for reviews. So
someone's talking about this.
Yeah.
That's all that really matters. Poggers.
Shelby, thank you so much for coming on for this week. If you want people to find you anywhere, where can they find you?
By whatever television is playing the Beetlejuice cartoon show. No, I'm just kidding. There are no televisions playing that show right now. We had to find a weird
VHS rip.
VHS rip on Dailymotion, which is never a good sign. I can be found across all social medias at Shelby_Fawn.
If you're looking for us, we can be reached by email at somanybitspodcast@gmail.com. Like us on Facebook, we're So Many Bits on there. Follow us on Twitter and Tumblr at So Many Bits. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Please rate and review or download from Simplecast, from SoundCloud, from YouTube, or stream via Spotify. We play games, twitch.tv/somanybits, Wednesday and Thursday nights, 8 p.m. Central Time. Recently, though, we did finish up our 12-hour Extra Life stream for charity, so you can check that out. Though normally, Wednesdays are for Magic the Gathering Online or MTG Arena, and Thursdays are for a variety of different games. Recently, I've played Symphony of the Night. I've played the Sega Genesis Mini. I've played a bunch of just a variety of games across all genres. So give that a look. Also give out a look to the other podcasts on nerdalogs.com. So Many Bits is on there, but a bunch of other great podcasts are too. And thank you very much. Have a great summer.
Honk. Honk, honk, honk. That's just a really long honk.
It's a honk, yes. Slowed down.